Hello and welcome to The Stack. For this week's show, I speak with the new editor of The World of Interiors. Plus, we pay a visit to New York's Art Book Fair. And we preview Monaco's France handbook. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We start the show celebrating a singular title, the venerated The World of Interiors. The upcoming June edition is the magazine's 500th issue. Following the industry legend Hamish Bowles, Emily Tobin took the helm as editor of The World of Interiors. She stopped by at our studio to talk about the magazine's future and what makes a World of Interiors story.
I've been at Condé Nast for a long time. I'm a long-time Condé Nast employee. Slightly terrifyingly, I think it will be 14 years this year. And I started off at House and Garden, another interiors title within the stable. And I had various roles there. I was initially a young fledgling writer, and I came in as PA to the previous editor, Sue Crewe. And then I had lots of different hats while I was there. So I was arts editor, I was features editor. I then went on to host a series of online talks for the magazine. And then in January 2022, I took a few very short steps down the corridor to the World of Interiors. And I came in as deputy editor to Hamish Bowles, who had just been appointed as editor. So that was incredibly exciting. You know, for me, the World of Interiors has always been a real beacon for me. I just love everything that they did and what we have gone on to do there. So I joined, it was a relatively new team. And then a few months into Hamish's editorship, very suddenly and very sadly, Hamish had a stroke in the autumn of that year. That was in October. And from that point on, I then became acting editor. So fast forwarding a year and a half or so, Hamish has made a really, really incredible, really deeply impressive recovery. In fact, it's something he has written about in the latest issue of Vogue, I think both the UK and the US editions. So I would urge people to read that if they can. And earlier this year, he stepped into a slightly different role at the World of Interiors. So he is now creative director at large, and I am officially editor, leading the brand from there on in.
Which makes sense after your involvement with the title. And how was it to work with Hamish? Because he's a legendary name as well. So there's kind of big shoes to fill in a way, right?
Hamish is a legendary name and he's a brilliant person. He's a deeply, deeply creative person. He's a very knowledgeable person and he has such breadth and depth of knowledge. So I feel so lucky to work with him and we've always worked really closely. We've got on very well. And from day one, we were very close collaborators. So yeah, I feel incredibly fortunate to be in this position and to continue to work that closely with him now.
And Emily, the World of Interior is one of my favorite things. It's quite unique. I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I have a feeling it must have such a strong and loyal fan base, if I may say. And not just in the UK, although it is a British publication, but I feel people, I'm sure there are a lot of French readers, American readers who says I must have the latest copy. It's quite unique in its space across design magazines in a way.
Absolutely. I think the World of Interiors is a byword for its singularity and uniqueness. I think from day one, it has always relished telling extraordinary stories. And we exist in this quite unusual place because we're part of the Condé Nast stable. And yet we've always sort of lurked on the sidelines. We're really far reaching in our interests. We're quite outlandish in our inspiration. And we really celebrate the weird and the wonderful and the oddity. And I think really what's at the heart of why it's been quite so successful and quite so popular for so long is because there's always been at the center of every World of Interiors story, there is this sense that place holds such power, spaces hold such power. And the way in which we live, the objects we choose to surround ourselves with, the spaces we inhabit, they really say so much about us. They really become receptacles for our identity. So there's always this kind of emotional heft behind what we're doing. And I think when you combine that with what I hope is really intelligent writing, very beautiful images, and also a really good dollop of humour, you know, I think we're known for having these very witty, eccentric headlines. We pay attention to everything. So that same care is taken in the stand, in the captions. And I have to say that is entirely the doing of our brilliant sub-editors who have this incredible elastic relationship with language and they can bend it into all sorts of magical shapes. And so, yeah, I hope it's a title that moves you, that makes you think, that sometimes makes you laugh. And, you know, we take our subject matter seriously without ever taking what we're doing too seriously.
I totally agree. And I'll give you an example why I love World of Interiors. I have the May issue. On page 64, you had, it's a, you know, fairly simple photo shoot, but of a few honey dippers or drizzlers. I mean, but the level of research, I didn't see that in other magazines. You know, it's quite a specific thing. And I'm sure it's quite a lot of research in it. There's, you know, it's not just the Fornoy Mason, but you have in other shops like Keep Store. I love that attention to detail of the magazine.
Exactly that. I think we're really conscious that actually we have quite a responsibility to find those makers and artists and craftspeople who are grafting away in different corners of the globe. It's really for us to go out and to find those people and to bring them to our readers. And I really want to instill in our team that, yeah, there's an element of responsibility there. You've got to find those people. You've got to keep those practices going. Sometimes you've got to keep those forms of craft going that may well be dying out. And that's really important. It's a valuable, valuable thing.
How you're, because, you know, of course, the World of Interiors, I was talking about the loyal fan base, and perhaps you have to be very careful if you want to change anything, because it's a very beloved title. And I know with a lot of magazines, there's always this discussion about print and digital. What's the World of Interiors' current approach about that? Of course, please tell me that the magazine is still the main thing, but how is that approach about digital? Are you going to put everything digitally or?
Yeah, it's a careful approach. We have launched the website. That happened in November 2022. So, as ever, the World of Interiors fashionably late to the party. But I think necessarily
that's cool.
So. It's cool, exactly. And we needed to take our time. And we have got this remarkably loyal fan base, some of whom have been with us right from the beginning. And we want to keep them with us and we want to take them with us onto whatever this next chapter might look like. We really wanted to be careful when it came to how the World of Interiors was going to exist online, because it's a brand that is synonymous with print. You know, it is a beautiful object. It is printed on the best paper stock in the building. You have the World of Interiors on your bookshelf or on your coffee table, and that says something about your aesthetics. It says something about your taste. It says something about your intellect. So how do you then translate that with that same gravitas to online? I think we have done that in several different ways. I think, first off, we've made sure that the print team and the digital team are fully integrated. Everyone is working across everything. And I think that's really important. Nothing in this balance feels secondary. So when you go to the website, you're getting pure World of Interiors. You're getting vintage World of Interiors. And some of the print stories will go up online, but there's a lot of digital first content on there as well. And perhaps unsurprisingly, there are other digital formats we've been experimenting with, which we're having really great success with. So something like the newsletter, unsurprisingly, does very well for us. It really suits us. It suits our content. It suits our readers. So that feels particularly exciting. And then, of course, there's video, which is a whole new world that we can explore. And we've been dipping our toe into that. And again, trying to bring that emotional weight to that sort of storytelling, that humour. And that feels particularly interesting. That is early days, but I think that's something that we're really going to be able to expand on and keep that curiosity level going.
And I have to say, I have here the brand new issue, actually, the June issue. So the first time I'm looking at it. And it's a very special one. It's issue 500. That's an incredible... And look at the cover. I mean, the cover is, if I can describe it, delicious.
It is delicious. Yeah, this landed on my desk this morning. So you and I...
Thank you for bringing it.
Seeing it very early days, but I'm so thrilled with it. And yes, as you say, remarkably, this is our 500th issue. So that is 42 years of the world of interiors. And it felt like a moment that we really had to celebrate. So we have looked back into our archive and we have looked back in order to look forward. So woven through this June issue, we have an A to Z of the world of interiors. So there are 26 essays, each of which represents a different part of the world of interiors DNA. A is for animal print, B is for Bauhaus, C is for clutter, D is for Delft, E is for eccentrics, the list goes on. Each letter has an essay, and each letter also has an artwork that we have commissioned or we have pulled out of our archive. And that's just been this incredible adventure to go on, because we have work from Zandra Rhodes, from Simone Rocher, and the cover, which you mention, is this exceptionally beautiful, colourful, juicy riff on Toile de Jouy. And that was created by Lubaina Himid, the Turner Prize-winning artist. So it feels really, really exciting. And toile is something that the world of interiors has had a very long-standing love affair with. And it's just fab to see it re-energized, reimagined by Lubaina on the June issue.
So when you look ahead for the world of interiors, are you optimistic? I mean, how is the magazine doing? Because as I said, I mean, and look at I have to say it's 300 pages, right? So it's hefty.
It's
like
a hefty thing. It is. It's a weighty object that's going to land on your doormat with a thud. No, we're feeling very, very positive about it. We all know it's a strange time to be in print, but for the world of interiors, we continue to flourish. Our subscribers continue to grow. As I said, we're seeing this growing audience online as well. And I think we just have to keep on approaching this thing with the love and the care that it deserves. It feels like the beginning of a really new and exciting chapter. And this 500th issue has been the perfect moment, actually, to take stock, look at where we've come from, and look at what we want to take from our history and use going forward, and then in turn, the ways that we can refresh it. So even within that, you know, we've got some really fun stories about the next generation of antique dealers, you know, the new talent that is coming up through the ranks. So yeah, I feel really very positive, very excited by it.
Thank you very much, Emily. And the World of Interiors June issue will be out this coming week. Over to New York City now, which last week hosted the New York Art Book Fair. It's the leading international gathering for the distribution of artist books defined as publications intended as artworks in their own right. It's run by Printed Matter, a non-profit organization founded in 1976, dedicated to the dissemination, understanding, and appreciation of artist books and related publications. Monaco Radio's New York correspondent Henry Rhys Sheridan was at the fair.
We are in Chelsea. My name is Sunil Breslov. I'm the director of fairs and editions at Printed Matter. I produce and direct the New York Art Book Fair and the LA Art Book Fair, which are organized by the nonprofit organization called Printed Matter, based in New York. We have our store, our main store in Chelsea, just around the corner from this amazing venue of the New York Art Book Fair, which just opened up last night. And we also have a store on St. Mark's, just downtown. And yeah, here we are. Beautiful day. Where we are hosting the fair this year, it's 548 West 22nd, between 10th and 11th Avenue. It is actually the location of the first ever New York Art Book Fair in 2006 and 2007. So it's an amazing building. You know, I'm expecting to have a wonderful experience myself, but also just, you know, excited for everybody to see all the books that are here this week.
So you mentioned that the history of this event goes back to 2006. Maybe you can just take me through the years since its inception, and how it's changed and how it's adapted to the changing publishing, art book publishing environment.
The fair was started in 2006 by A. Bronson, an artist, but also somebody who is part of the Print to Matter family for many, many years. And it was, I think, very kind of community-driven from the start, artist-driven from the start. There were 70 to 100 publishers in the first couple years. And I think that what we see today, which the fair is now hosting over 300 exhibitors international from all around the world, we are seeing really a testament to the power of the artist book form, to the interest in this material, to the interest in kind of working in a form that is so accessible and speaks to so many people. The first couple years, there was a kind of strong contingent of some publishers that were there then that return now. So you'll find a good amount of publishers who have been with this production for its entire history. And it's amazing to see that energy. It's amazing to see their work adapt. It's amazing to see the form adapt and just all the creativity that's on display.
And you mentioned too that there's a companion LA Art Book Fair. What's the relationship between the two events, and what do you make of kind of the strength of regionalism in art book publishing in the United States? You know, particularly with kind of the internet bringing people closer together, is regionalism still important?
I think it's an interesting question. I think for LA and for many years, and even last August when we had our last LA Art Book Fair, we do really think about like the West Coast demographic, both of just who's there, you know, and who's interested and who's making work there, but also like how the proximity of to Asia and to Latin America, there is a lot more representation, I would say, from those regions. I want to say that in New York, we're really kind of quickly catching up, and just the proliferation of this medium and the kind of knowledge of the technology around it, the printing technologies and methods are things that people are adapting and thinking about all over the world. And the fair, the New York Art Book Fair, is like, I think, a big kind of achievement for so many people. So there are hundreds of artist book fairs that happen all year round, all around the world. And I think that this one is something that a lot of people see as like a goal to get to, because they understand that it really is such a massive platform. At the same time, for us, seeing all these projects happening around the world, we often are engaging with them through the internet. We're seeing projects for the first time through Instagram. We're seeing projects through the first time through like hearing about these other art book fairs. I mean, we, I think, are really embracing of just ways in which we can learn about projects and how we can then find ways, be resourceful about how do we bring them to New York and make sure that they can really, we can meet them in person, we can see that material in person, really kind of like touch those books, but also that they can engage with our audiences.
So obviously this event kind of shines a light on independent art book publishers. What do you think about the relationship, the current relationship, between legacy art publishers and independent art publishers? Do you think that it's a healthy one?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that everyone is really excited to be actually sharing space, and that's a really important component of this particular fair. We are not a zine fair. We are not a photo fair, photo art book fair. We are not specific to small press. We're everything. We have the antiquarian art book dealers next to the small press, next to the institutions, next to the galleries, next to the zine makers and the independent artists self-publishing. And so I think that they all kind of rub off on each other and are eager to meet each other and embrace the work, learn about the work, share resources. I mean, that's the kind of, I think, very unique thing about this production in particular. It is everyone. And I want to say it's like kind of, I don't want to say it's the best of everyone, but it's like what we're most excited about this year in particular. That's what the fair is. We get over 1,000 applications for participants, and we try to narrow it down to 300. And we try to make it as diverse as possible, regionally diverse, materially, you know, kind of compelling and diverse. And we're really excited then, you know, to open the doors and see what kind of happens, you know, between everybody.
The New York Art Book Fair brings together exhibitors from over 30 countries outside of the USA. Jonas von Lenter is the head of Wirklichkeit Books from Germany.
I'm Jonas. I'm based in Berlin. I run Wirklichkeit Books, a small press. We publish art books, political discourse, and so on.
What does coming here kind of achieve for you in terms of meeting people, promoting what you do? Like, how important is it for you?
I think, because I always come with really high expectations, and in general to New York I come with these expectations, and I think first of all there's a huge appreciation for these kinds of things, that you can sense that when you are in touch with the readers at the booth. But also, I mean, it's great to connect with bookshops, with potential distributors. These things are really good, and also potential authors, and to sense what is being talked about in the city is, I think, very important.
How would you compare it to the scene that you operate within in Europe?
So I think I would say, I mean, that's only my observation, but I would say that the zine culture is bigger here, the kind of DIY way of making publications. Like, I think in Europe it's possible to inhabit a in-between space of between small and big. And I have a feeling here it's more either small DIY or big. And I would say that's a difference, but it's really like every day I consider new differences or commons between the two contexts.
There are hundreds of contemporary book publishers exhibiting at the fair, but there's also a robust presence of antiquarian book dealers. Arthur Fournier is one of them.
Hi, my name is Arthur Fournier. I'm a rare bookseller. I work as a broker for manuscripts and archives related to 20th century culture. The Printed Matter New York Art Book Fair is a mainstay on my calendar. It's been part of my practice for about a decade now. I have used it as a space to show ephemera, underground magazines, and rare books that aren't canonical, but are sort of like, I would say, interesting and important material that we don't know about, things that have been omitted or overlooked in sort of the known literature around art and social protest movements.
How do you see yourself and other rare book dealers fitting into the kind of broader ecosystem of independent publishing?
Well, independent publishing, for my mind, is a place where the democratization of print culture has happened. After the Second World War, people started using mimeograph machines and eventually Xerox photoduplicating equipment to sometimes silk screens and risograph, etc., to bring their voice into the world of discourse, right? Printed discourse, material text. And so that's still happening. So you have young publishers here maybe making things in their basements or in collaborative working spaces in Bushwick and Bed-Stuy, you know, who perhaps printed something yesterday morning. Whereas I might have a material that was made in the 1960s or the 1970s or the 1980s by artists in their moment, using available methods and using inexpensive means to produce printed objects that carried a message that was important in their time. So by the time it's in my remit, it's historical, but I think it's part of a continuum. And you see that full continuum in the room today.
Tell me about the kind of most exciting objects in your possession that you're exhibiting and selling here this time around.
One of the things that I'm most interested in and proudest to have in my booth is a collection of material by a Texas-born Choctaw Assiniboine poet named Roxy Gordon. He was a member of a community of Native poets in Texas, but he was also part of the outlaw country scene. So he was friends with people like Hoyt Axton and Billy Joe Shaver and Towns Van Zandt. But he really wrote about contemporary life as an Indian in the United States in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I think his poetry is fantastic, and it's crucially overlooked. And I'm hoping to place that collection with a library where it can be available for further study.
From the New York Art Book Fair in New York City, I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
That was Henry Rhys Sheridan reporting from the New York Art Book Fair. And time to talk about a new Monocle publication. It's France, the Monocle Handbook. There you will discover our most cherished Gaelic spots. We tour the country from Marseille to Montpellier, Biarritz to Brittany, stopping by at the best bistros, elegant ateliers, and storied hotels to find out what makes this refined nation the world's most visited. It was great talking with Claudia Jacob, researcher for our books team, who was heavily involved with the production of the book. Claudia Jacob, welcome to The Stack. I think this is your debut in The Stack, right?
I'm honored to be on the show.
It's a pleasure. I mean, I had to invite you this week because our book, France, The Monocle Handbook, is out. Please, Claudia, just give us an introduction about The Monocle Handbook. This is, I believe, the third installment, right?
The third installment. So the first was Portugal, then Spain, and now France. And as with our previous two handbooks, it's a travel guide, but it's a lot more than a travel guide. It's a guidebook, it's a little companion to have while you're traveling, but I think also it's a celebration of everything that is so amazing about France as a country and everything that it means to be French, whether that's fashion, design, food, everything that comes to mind when you think of this amazing European country.
And what a country, France, as you rightly said. Very diverse as well. I mean, and I'm very glad there's quite a few pages dedicated to food and drink.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for that.
It's a large part of it.
It's a large, and I presume, I mean, because France, I mean, is physically bigger than, you know, Spain and Portugal. So this has been a lot of hard work. I mean, I'm sure there's been a lot of research. I'm sure you've been to the country many times. Tell us a bit more about that.
It was quite a task, I must say, to divide it up. I mean, with my team, with Amy, who's our deputy editor of Book Publishing, and also our freelancers and correspondents who are based all over the country, we sort of split up the country between us, divided it by region. And really, it was a case of doing some quite intense research, drilling down into what it was that Monocle likes about France, what's so special about the country. And then once we'd done all that research, it was a case of actually being on the ground. So we all went to France, we separated into our various different regions, and we visited all the places that we'd researched and found and places that we previously featured in Monocle to see if they were still sort of, you know, along the right lines. But then also a really key aspect of reporting when it comes to a travel guide is actually just discovering stuff spontaneously. So I'd say there was, you know, half the stuff was stuff I'd researched and the other half was stuff that I just came across while I was there. I'd go in, I'd have a chat with the owner, see what they were about. And yeah, you can kind of get a sense quite quickly of what a place is about and what they're doing there. But then the hardest part probably was coming back and coming together as a team and then, you know, having some, let's
edit
say,
down.
Some heated debates, let's say, about who had found the best fruit market and which boulangerie was the best one, which fromagerie should make it in. When you're doing a book that covers an entire country and one as big as France, as you say, it's really tough to try and narrow it down and to also have a strong sort of amount of variety so that you're not featuring everything in Paris or everything in Marseille, etc. So yeah, it's a task, but it's really good fun. And it really forces you to think, why is this place the best? Why is it the most special? And that's, yeah, a skill that I've definitely had to hone along the way.
And Claudia, you're mentioning Paris. One thing that I'm very happy about the book, because I love Paris. I mean, it's generally my favorite city. It's the best of the best. But at the same time, I have a feeling that I don't have too much knowledge of other parts of France. And there's plenty of it in this book. It's definitely not, I wouldn't say it's Paris heavy. There's a lot of things about Paris, but you have Marseille, you have the south of France. I mean, everywhere, literally.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, we've really scoped out the French capital, and that's something that we had to do in quite a lot of detail because, as you say, I mean, Paris is the most visited capital city in the world. It's extremely popular, but people sort of have, I'd say, like quite set restaurants and shops that they like to visit, and those are the ones that are quite well known. So what we actually wanted to do is say, how can we feature Paris, but feature a different side of Paris that celebrates it for everything that it already is and that people love it for, but actually shows a different side of it? And then when it comes to the rest of France, I mean, yeah, we've got loads of stuff on Marseille and how this industrial port has, you know, revitalized itself to repurpose some really cool buildings. We've got, you know, the best Boucher in Lyon, you know, we've got the rustic beaches in Brittany, we've got a quick trip over to the island of Corsica, and it's a really, yeah, it's a celebration of the diversity of everything that France has to offer, without forgetting, of course, a trip to the Alps, which was a very important part of the book. How do we integrate the mountains with the sun? How do we make sure that this, you know, elegant mountain range is represented alongside all of the beautiful coastlines that you find in France?
Well, I have to say, one of my favorite parts of the book were about the bookshops, because I think France has amazing ones. But give us perhaps some of your highlights, some of the places you visited. Could be a restaurant, a shop, a city even.
Yeah, so I actually went to the western city of Nantes, which was a really interesting place. They've got some really interesting cultural initiatives going on there. And one of my favourite places I visited was called the Hab Galerie, stands for Angor à Banane, which basically means it was the place where bananas were stored when they were shipped over from Africa, something that's reminiscent of France's colonial past. And it's now been rehabilitated into a contemporary gallery space, which I think really shows you the plucky cultural spirit of the city. They've really done well at repurposing their buildings, about thinking about how they can make the city more livable, about how they can attract small businesses, how they can attract students. And it was a really cool space to go and visit, really nice and airy, and it's right by their trading port. So that was really cool. My favourite place in Paris, which has made it in the cafe section, is a cafe which is in La Musée de la Vie Romantique. It's the Rose Bakery, which you probably know very well. I mean, they've done countless fashion shows. They've catered for countless cultural institutions. And in the Musée de la Vie Romantique, it's this beautiful cafe housed in a bucolic greenhouse. It feels really worlds away from the buzzy metropole of Paris. And you can have a sip of tea there and have some pâtisserie. And it's right on the hill of Montmartre. And it's a super special place. And it's one of those places that people really don't associate with Paris, because Paris, you know, is all about how busy it is and all the fashion atelier and all the design workshops they've got going on there. But this cafe is, yeah, it's pretty special.
Great recommendation. And of course, the Olympics are coming. They're Monaco coming. Is expanding to Paris as well. It's all about France.
It's all happening. It's all about France. And I think that's what's important about the Monocle Handbook, is it's not just a travel guide. It's not just about being a tourist, but it's about what's being French. And I think the French really know how to live life well. And that's something we've tried to get across in all of our pages.
Thank you very much, Claudia. And France, the Monaco Handbook is out now. Go to monaco.com for more. And now I'm introducing a new segment to the show. It's things I've read or little recommendations that I came across this week. We start with this great publication about magazines, Grub Street Journal. Joanna Cummings and Peter Houston were guests of the Stack earlier this year, and their new issue is out. And not only I am featured in the new issue, which I'm very glad, talking a bit more about my work here at Monaco, but they have other great features like the art of the magazine photo shoot and what we can learn from the best children's magazines. If you are interested, do check them out at grubstreetjournal.com. And that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Jack Jewers. If you have any comments or queries, drop me a line on fb@monaco.com. We're back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Meanwhile, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. It's goodbye from me.